This is the, I want to show this Time magazine cover. This is the famous July 3rd, 1995. I don't know whether it's really famous, but it's famous in, for people who have an interest in this cover, where Time magazine reported on this study by this Carnegie, by this, this Carnegie Mellon study about how much pornography there was online. And exclusive, a new study shows how pervasive and wild it really is. Can we protect our kids and free speech? I love the cover. We wanted to put it in the book. I wanted to illustrate that section of the book with this cover, but Time magazine wanted $1,500 for us to reproduce the cover. So we decided we just have to go with a verbal description of what it showed. But it's a very nice, dramatic picture. Now, you know, it turned out, as we say, that this study was done by a Carnegie Mellon undergraduate who was not a sociologist or anything like that. He was just a computer science undergraduate who was interested in pornography. But be that as it may, the reports, the comments of this were read into the congressional record by Senator Grassley, I think, some of the same people who are still around.
'95, most of those people are still around.
Most of those people are still around. So, so what happened when Congress got thrown into a tizzy about the fact that children might see dirty pictures online that their parents wouldn't want them to see? They passed a law. The law had been up, had been under discussion, but it hadn't, didn't look like it was going anywhere at this point, at that point, because the civil liberties groups were upset about it. And they passed this thing called the Communications Decency Act. And the Communications Decency Act was a long bill. And the two parts of it that are of significance to us are referred to as the display provisions one part of it is, we're just going to call this part the display provisions. We'll get to the rest of the story in a moment. So here's what the CDA said about showing stuff. It said it criminalized, made it a crime for anyone who knowingly, A, uses an interactive computer service to send a specific person or persons under 18 years of age, or B, uses any interactive computer service to display in a manner available to a person under 18 years of age any comment, request, suggestion, proposal, image, or other communication that in context, depicts or describes in terms patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards, sexual or excretory activities or organs. And then it goes on and makes it also a crime to transmit obscene or indecent materials to someone known to be under the age of 18, where indecent is undefined in the statute. Okay, so the background here, I haven't taken you through the whole thing, but if you read this, because I didn't want to make this whole class all about sex, but if you read the section of the book, you'll know that case of Miller in California from 1974, the Supreme Court had gone through the exercise of finally trying to settle once and for all what was obscene and therefore completely illegal in the United States and not available. No one could have it on the internet, in a movie, in a print publication, nothing. There was no internet in 74, of course. But and this was the culmination of a really bizarre chapter in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court, which had always had a lot of trouble with this. Because there were some justices who refused to... They actually had to decide a series of dirty movie cases. And the nine justices would watch the dirty movie and decide whether it was obscene or not. And they'd set a standard, and then they'd come back, and somebody would come up with some variation on the theme, and they'd have to watch another dirty movie. This is, you know, almost unimaginable that they would do this. And certain of the justices actually refused to watch any of it because they said the First Amendment is just absolute. There is no limit. There is nothing that can be made illegal. Well, in the end, the court didn't accept that position, and it came up with this thing called the Miller test. And part of the Miller test refers to community standards. That's why we, as measured by contemporary community standards. Now, in the Miller test example, the community standards have to do with local geography. So the community standards of Nashville, Tennessee, are not the same as the community standards of San Jose, California. Okay, so this community standards language has been carried across here, although it's hard to know exactly what it could refer to since this whole thing is about electronic communications. But nonetheless, they borrowed the language because they knew that was the language of the Miller test when they put it in there. And they also criminalized, and there's this other important phrase, obscene or indecent materials of someone known to be under the age of 18. Well, obscene, they needn't have bothered to mention it because it's already illegal to transmit obscene materials to anyone over 18 or under 18. So the only force in this thing is this new term, indecent. And there's no definition in the Communications Decency Act of what's indecent. So the expectation was that just as the judges eventually set a standard on what was obscene, they would also have to figure out what was indecent. So this is another one of these laws. This is now not a decision, this is a law that the civil liberties groups argued would make it extremely difficult to do business under, because this standard is undefined and this community is undefined. And then in addition to that, you have a problem of somehow, let's just think about this now in terms of the web. Suppose you were, Playboy.com, just to take something that's, I think they're generally agreed, is within the orbit of what adults should be able to go into a magazine store and buy, as distasteful as one may think it is. Suppose you were running Playboy.com, how would you respond to the requirement that you not show the Playboy images in a manner available to a person under 18 years of age? What would you do? So this business of age verification actually is a continuing saga. The age verification problem has two sides to it. One side is this one, that there are reasons to want technologies that will keep children out of places that children shouldn't go. But the other side of it is the demand for technologies that will keep adults out of places that only children should go, or only children and, you know, a designated set of responsible adults that are, you know, pre-certified. and the so this is the you know the whole worry about child predators going on MySpace or something and accosting children and you know and so on. So this was litigated. The ACLU and a number of other you know complainants took the thing to court. And the Supreme Court very substantially overruled this, said this was too, it was too simple, it was too sweeping a requirement. And it would have made it too difficult for adults to participate in getting information that was legal for adults. And in particular, there was a big objection to any kind of solution to this problem of keeping children away that would require adults to identify themselves. Because it's kind of a basic principle that when you go into a library as an adult and sit down and read a book, you know, you don't have to say who you are. And when you walk into a bookstore and buy a book and pay cash, right, you've got a right to buy books without identifying yourselves in general. You know, there should not be laws that a law that required everybody to register when they bought a book would be illegal under the First Amendment in this country, because that would be an unreasonable chilling of free speech to require, you know, people wouldn't read stuff if they thought the government was going to know that they were reading it. So there's a whole objection there to any solution that would involve adults to have to somehow register with the website in order to gain access to information that's perfectly legal for adults to have. And then there was the whole problem about vagueness. And, you know, just take one paragraph out of this. You know, how would you know whether you were operating within the law or not? Could a speaker that means somebody publishing stuff on a website. Could a speaker confidently assume that a serious discussion about birth control practices, homosexuality, the First Amendment issues raised by the appendix to our Pacifica opinion? So this is an opinion about broadcast, you know, which dirty words you can and can't say on broadcast television. So just even reading a Supreme Court decision, if it talked about the wrong stuff, or the consequences of prison rape would not violate the CDA. How would you know? When you went to post a newspaper article or something like that, whether this was going to be, in the opinion of the court, indecent and therefore the sort of thing that you really had to make sure no child could see, even a 17-year-old. This uncertainty undermines the likelihood that the CDA has been carefully tailored to the congressional goal of protecting minors from potentially harmful materials. So this, the argument is, and there's a series of, you know, court decisions in this area, that, you know, the principle of trying to protect minors from potentially harmful materials is fine. That's a worthy thing to do. And Congress can make laws, but they can't do it by drawing such a big circle around what's indecent and making it so hard for adults to see to see that. That it rules out, in practice, you know, lots of the kinds of reading that adults can do by going into bookstores or going into libraries or so on. So you got this thing about careful tailoring or narrow tailoring. Whatever laws you pass really have to be aimed just at, you know, the target problem and not sweep too much else up in it. So this, the Communications Decency Act, these display provisions were ruled unconstitutional and, you know, are in fact not the law of the land. So that was another thread in the development of the place where we are today.